And so I left my business career, and suffice it to say, took a sizable cut in pay to engage in what I consider to be far more important work, and that is pressing the truth into our culture and trying to offer a reasonable, rational argument for some level of moral sanity. We seem to be losing all moral sanity in this culture. And so here I am 7 years later. I lead an organization, the Center for Christ and Culture, that seeks to equip the church in particular, primarily, with an intelligent, thoughtful rationale for defending biblical, moral, and ethical principles in culture. Somebody has to shape culture. Somebody is shaping our moral and ethical values in culture. And I would argue that the church has just as much, if not more, to say about those issues than anyone else. And it has not done a good job of asserting that position as it could have, or as it has in times past. So that gives you a little background of how I came to be where I am. And so with that, I want to go ahead and begin my lecture, which is entitled Pornography, the Deconstruction of Human Sexuality. Robert George, the Princeton law professor, pointed out in his book, The Clash of Orthodoxies, that legal prohibition of anything works well only when supported by a widespread recognition of the evil of the thing prohibited. In a society that no longer holds to the widespread recognition of the evil that pornography represents, this, it seems, is our first challenge when addressing the issue of pornography and the proposed or any proposed restriction thereof. Following the unprecedented proliferation of pornography that has occurred in the last 20 years, there are many today who have removed pornography from any moral category whatsoever and simply regard this as a simple First Amendment issue. In fact, according to research by George Barna, conducted in November of 2003, 38% of American adults surveyed stated that pornography was morally acceptable. And this is the first supposition that we must address. Is pornography morally acceptable, or is it in fact immoral? And if we suppose it immoral, on what basis do we make this distinction? Regardless of one's religious beliefs, most rational people can agree that behavior which does harm could be categorized as immoral, evil, or wrong. Therefore, we can likely agree that we as a society have an interest in and responsibility to prohibit or restrain certain behaviors in order to eliminate harm to both individuals and society in general. This would be regarded as public morality. And Robert George, again, offers an excellent definition of public morality. Quote, public morality, like public health and safety, is a concern that goes beyond considerations of law and public policy. Public morals are affected, for good or ill, by the activities of private parties. And such parties have obligations with respect to them. Close quote. Contrary to the belief that private behavior, or in this case, the private use of pornography, is somehow not the concern of anyone else, private behavior is of concern simply because it does in fact affect public morals, and therefore it does have public consequences. For example, even apart from laws prohibiting the creation of fire hazards, individuals have an obligation to avoid placing persons and property in jeopardy of fire. And while this example addresses a health and safety issue, it is nonetheless the same with respect to the moral obligations imposed by society upon private behaviors, which also produce public consequences, such as pornography. And so it is with this in mind that we examine the issue of pornography. And we examine pornography in an effort to understand how this private behavior affects public morality and society, and how this then serves as a justification for governmental restriction and or prohibition of pornographic materials. So we begin with a simple question. Does pornography cause harm? And to adequately answer this question, we first must recover a proper, and I would add, healthy view of sex. A view of sex that fully integrates the psychological, emotional, physical, and life-giving or procreative potential, I would argue, is a comprehensive and proper view of human sexuality. This perspective provides the only foundation for intimacy that is built upon mutual love and respect with a high view of humanity. Sexual intimacy, by its very nature, is something deeply personal, marked by the sharing of one's innermost self. It is an act of unrestrained exposure to our most vulnerable physical and emotional self. And for this reason, a relationship rooted in mutual trust and respect has proven essential to a truly fulfilling sexual experience. And this would explain why, statistically speaking, married couples overwhelmingly report feeling much more sexually satisfied than non-married couples. This is one of the principal reasons why marriage is so integral to healthy sexuality. It represents the highest level of commitment, integrating persons psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, as well as physically. It is within the context of such a relationship that people discover the emotional and physical security that is necessary to experience true sexual freedom. And there is much more that could be said regarding marriage and its intrinsic relationship to sex. However, for the purposes of our examination of pornography, I'm going to stop there. The other view of sexuality, and frankly the more pervasive or popular view in today's culture, is by contrast a disintegrated view, which attempts to separate the physical from its other integrating aspects. Sex, in this sense, is then reduced to mere copulation, and persons are instrumentalized or viewed as objects of sexual gratification. And this is radically different than the one view I just described, and serves as the basis for a whole host of negative perceptions and consequences. For one, this view is inherently dehumanizing. It reduces persons to nothing more than objects whose value is instrumental rather than intrinsic. Meaning our perceptions of men and women are brought down to their most base forms as objects whose sole purpose is to meet the objectifier's needs. This is inherently dehumanizing. This shift in thinking denies the intrinsic value of people and thus renders them less than human. It encourages and fosters a low view of humanity as opposed to a high view of humanity. And the fact is, history has demonstrated that any society which adopts a view of others as being less than human will necessarily become desensitized and indifferent to human equality. And this ultimately leads to a culture in which the abuse of those so objectified only increases. And this might account for the unprecedented increase in violence against women and the epidemic rape rates in this country that have occurred in the period since the so-called sexual revolution began in the 1960s. In addition, this disintegrated view of sexuality is inherently selfish and narcissistic. Sex is divorced from love of and relationship to, and instead is reduced to sport, producing a conquest mentality. True human intimacy has no place in such a system. Sex is no longer an act of mutual love, sharing, and vulnerability, but simply self-centered gratification. The gratification of self above all else becomes the purpose and aim of all sexual encounters. Again, this is in sharp contrast to a proper view of human sexuality, which advocates and achieves the highest satisfaction through an emphasis on the other instead of on the self. Boston College philosophy professor Peter Craig summed this up well when he wrote, "America does not know the difference between money and sex. It treats sex like money because it treats sex as a medium of exchange. And it treats money like sex because it expects its money to get pregnant and reproduce." This is the view of sexuality and human relationships that pornography promotes and idealizes to the exclusion of all others. This would explain why, in large part, pornography has such strong appeal upon men, among men in particular. Because the difficult and sometimes challenging aspects of building a relationship, a real relationship, are completely removed. This gives the user of pornography access to sex without any of the accompanying commitments. When you couple this with the visual medium, which is a powerful sexual stimulant to men, you have the makings of a very potent platform for the perversion of male views pertaining to sex, as well as relationships and women. As one researcher put it, quote, "Pornography presents a graphic, degrading picture of human life and invites the viewer to wallow in it. Pornography plunges him into an imaginative preoccupation with autoerotic fantasies, where he entertains himself by violently or sexually feeding, vicariously, on the helplessness or willing vulnerability of a no longer human animal." Close quote. If pornography does indeed promote this disintegrated view of sexuality that I have described, and which all of the social science seems to confirm, then we must ask, does such a view actually produce any tangible negative consequences? Dr. Victor Kline, professor of psychology at the University of Utah, identified as early as 1985 that exposure to pornography was in fact capable of producing profound psychological and behavioral changes. Dr. Kline conducted a clinical case history study of approximately 225 males who had sexual pathology resulting from their involvement with pornography. And Dr. Kline reported that of those males who became immersed in pornography, there appeared a near-universal four-factor syndrome characterizing their experience with and effect of pornography use. And this four-factor syndrome identified by Dr. Kline is as follows. The first thing that happens is an addiction effect. There seemed to be a clear psychological addiction to this material. Once involved, the men kept coming back for more and still more. The material provided a very powerful sexual stimulant or aphrodisiac effect, followed by some kind of sexual release. Secondly, there was an escalation effect. With the passage of time, these men required more explicit, rougher, more deviant kinds of sexual material to get their highs and sexual turn-ons. The third thing that happened was desensitization. Materials that were originally perceived as shocking, taboo-breaking, repulsive, or immoral, even though still sexually arousing, in time were seen as acceptable and commonplace. These behaviors, in a sense, became legitimized in their minds. The fourth thing that occurred was an increasing tendency to act out the sexual activities witnessed in the pornography that had been viewed. This involved a great variety of acts, including the sexual seduction of children and sexual aggression against women. And this is not to suggest that every person who views pornography will inevitably experience any or all of these four stages, but it demonstrates the progressively degenerating potential of pornography consumption. There is something very, very powerful taking place within the psyche of a person with long-term exposure to pornography. And this is further confirmed by the research of Dr. James McCall at the University of California, Irvine, in his groundbreaking work on memory. Dr. McCall's work suggests that experiences at times of emotional or sexual arousal get locked in the brain by the chemical epinephrine, and they become virtually impossible to erase. And according to Dr. McGall, this may help explain pornography's addictive effect. It is the combination of visual stimulation and chemical response working together to produce a powerful physiological phenomenon. In pornography, sexual stimulation is achieved visually, primarily, and the chemical and physiological process then begins. However, the object of arousal is not a person in an anthropological sense. It's not a real human being, but an artificial image of a person that exists outside of any real and meaningful relationship. The user of pornography is then focused on his own gratification to the exclusion of all others, even if he is viewing the pornography with a sexual partner. Furthermore, by integrating pornography into his sexual experience, he is becoming increasingly dependent upon the stimulation of the image and not a live, living person. Again, it is copulation. It is the physical divorce from these multidimensional aspects of the sexual experience, which makes it inherently dehumanizing. This provides the escalation then described by Dr. Klein, in which the person enters the escalation stage. In addition, this person is becoming more and more disconnected from relationship as the context in which they experience sexual gratification. Nowhere do you find any positive effects resulting from habitual exposure to pornography. None. There are no documented improvements in a person's attitude toward the opposite sex or relationships in general. The tendency is then not toward a higher view of sex, relationships, and humanity, but in every case, it is a perverted view of intimacy, a dysfunctional view of relationships, and a dehumanizing view of women in particular. Dr. Klein accurately stated, "If there is some suspicion that the drinking water, for example, is contaminated and people are getting ill after drinking it, the burden of proof shifts to proving it is safe rather than having final conclusive proof that it is indeed toxic." I think that this situation now pretty clearly applies to the pornography area, he concludes. What has been addressed thus far is the fact that pornography most certainly and in almost every way adversely affects the person using pornography and those in relationship to them. But the question remains, how does this affect society in general, the rest of us? How does this private behavior then translate into a public consequence, in other words? Let's begin by examining the unprecedented proliferation of pornography that has taken place in the last four decades, and then we will attempt to correlate these facts with a number of related societal ills. In 1973, Americans spent approximately $10 million a year on pornography. By 1999, the pornography industry took in more than $8 billion. More recently, that figure was placed at $12 billion. In addition, it is estimated that online sex sites generate, at the very least, another $1 billion in annual revenues. And these figures, of course, do not even begin to include the free pornographic material that is currently available in abundance on the internet, not to mention the estimated 2.5 billion pornographic emails that are sent each day. 2.5 billion each day. I did read something in the news this morning that caught my eye that was very interesting. A mother was staying at a hotel. She had her young children. She went into the bathroom to take a bath. They turned on the television and were able to access pornography. She sued them and was awarded $85,000. I thought, that's a great tactic right there. And that's surprising in our culture that a jury would reach such a conclusion. But there is still some recognition that pornography may at least be harmful to children. I hope we haven't come that far. So we've seen this massive proliferation of pornography, and of course this raises the supply and demand question. In other words, did the increase in availability produce an increase in demand, or were pornographers simply responding to the existing market demands? And to answer this question, we have to examine several convergent factors that I think will demonstrate that it was the supply that preceded the so-called demand for pornography. Since the founding of America, there has always been some form of legal prohibition against obscene or pornographic materials. And the definition of obscenity remained, for the most part, objectively understood in a society that made clear moral distinctions pertaining to sexual conduct. However, in the wake of the sexual revolution in the 1960s, these standards became less clear, more subjective, and thus no longer associated with a universal moral consensus. Beginning in the 1960s, First Amendment protections were invoked by pornographers, claiming that any restriction of obscene material was a violation of so-called free speech. Therefore, steps had to be taken to further define obscenity. In the Miller versus California case of 1973, the current definition and legal prohibitions against obscene material were put in place, having been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that, quote, "This much has been categorically settled by the court, that obscene material is unprotected by the First Amendment," close quote. While there remains some room for interpretation, obscenity was nonetheless defined, and the Supreme Court affirmed that such material was not protected by the First Amendment. From then until 1992, obscenity was successfully and vigorously prosecuted both by federal and state governments. Then in 1992, under the Clinton administration, the Justice Department virtually abandoned the prosecution of obscenity. This led one porn industry insider to comment prior to the 2000 presidential election, quote, "How likely is it that we are going to enjoy the same benevolent neglect that the industry has enjoyed under Janet Reno?" Close quote. Unfortunately, this benevolent neglect could not have come at a worse time in history. With the advent of the internet in the early 90s, coupled with an absence of fear from prosecution, the pornography industry found and capitalized on the perfect medium of distribution. It was affordable, accessible, and anonymous. Every previous barrier to pornography, including child pornography, bestiality, sadomasochism, and every perverse expression imaginable, was suddenly and utterly eliminated. And this condition alone should raise universal concern over pornography, given the often unrestricted access of children to these materials, and worse, the unrestricted access of pornographers to our children. Every person, whether they be liberal or conservative, religious or atheistic, is compelled by conscience to protect the most innocent among us, children. And it has long been known that internet pornographers have utilized deceptive and unscrupulous marketing methodologies that target children. In the past, pornographers have incorporated keywords and meta tags into their websites, words such as Nintendo, Disney, doll, so that children entering these words into internet search engines might inadvertently click onto a link in the search results, which would then lead them to a pornographic site. What possible interest could pornographers have in marketing their so-called products to an audience with little or no means to generate revenue, except to cultivate future consumers? Very clearly, pornographers understand the addictive nature of their own product in much the same way that tobacco companies do. We're absolutely outraged, and we take legislative steps to stop the tobacco industry from targeting children, and in many cases, adults as well. And yet any attempts to protect children from exposure to pornography are met with resistance, for fear of infringing upon some perceived constitutional right of pornographers to do as they please, regardless of harm. Consequently, more and more children today are being exposed to pornography and the inculcation of this disintegrated view of sexuality. Dr. Mark Laser, a nationally known psychologist specializing in sexual addiction, testified before a joint congressional committee in May of 2000. He said the average age of initial exposure to pornography for boys is now age 5. prior to the advent of the internet, the average age was around 15 to 16. And this was mostly Playboy-type publications, magazines. Given the current trends, it is safe to say that if steps are not taken to stem the tide of pornographic materials, we will likely see a generation of young men incapable, utterly incapable, of normal, healthy sexuality and relationships, creating an era of unprecedented family dissolution, sexual dysfunction, and abuse. Pornography has certainly been in existence since the earliest civilizations. However, its presence and effects remain somewhat limited up until this point. The convergence of these two factors, prosecutorial neglect, along with a ubiquitous and cheap distribution channel, the internet, have provided an unabated flow of pornographic material into society, producing an ever-increasing demand, and with it, a host of deleterious societal consequences. As we have already seen, pornography very clearly affects individuals and those in relationship to them. And we have addressed the question of supply versus demand, the legality surrounding pornography, and of course, the risk to children. So now let us return to the question of pornography's broader societal impact. Does society have a common interest in the presence and use of pornography? As we have learned, pornographic images are indeed capable of provoking powerful psychological and physiological responses in people that engender then a specific view of sexuality that I have termed disintegrated. And this disintegrated view then alters how one views relationships, themselves, and in particular the opposite sex. Furthermore, we have seen how this altered view never edifies or builds up, but rather dehumanizes persons and breaks down relationships. It undermines human relationship. Therefore, it's logical to conclude that these persons will project those attitudes on others in sometimes destructive or antisocial behaviors. And the research in this area appears to confirm this. For example, the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department's Sexually Exploited Child Unit, examined the relationship between extrafamilial, outside the family, child sexual abuse, and pornography. In their cases, over a 10-year period from 1980 to 1989, and pornography was directly involved in 62% of the cases, and actually recovered in 55% of the total cases. The study's author concluded this. He said this, quote, "Clearly, pornography, whether it be adult or child pornography, is an insidious tool in the hands of the pedophile population. The study merely confirms what detectives have long known, that pornography is a strong factor in the sexual victimization of children," close quote. In another study of adult sex offenders, researchers found that 86% of convicted rapists said they were regular users of pornography, with 50% admitting direct imitation of pornographic scenes they enjoyed in the commission of their rapes. Close quote. Michigan State Police Detective Daryl Pope found that of the 38,000 sexual assault cases in Michigan between 1956 and 1979, in 41% of the cases, pornographic material was viewed just prior to or during the crime. In his introduction to the final report of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, columnist Michael McManus noted that the FBI interviewed 24 sex murderers in prison who had killed multiple numbers of times. Some 81% said their biggest sexual interest was in reading pornography. They acted out sex fantasies on real people. For example, Arthur Gary Bishop, convicted of sexually abusing and killing 5 young boys, said, quote, "If pornographic material would have been unavailable to me in my early states, it is most probable that my sexual activities would not have escalated to the degree that they did," close quote. He said pornography's impact on him was devastating. He said, quote, I am a homosexual pedophile convicted of murder, and pornography was a determining factor in my downfall. Close quote. Proponents of pornography will argue that these are merely extreme cases that involve a number of other factors which are ignored, such as socioeconomic, early family conditions, mental illness, etc. They argue that attempts to isolate pornography as a contributing cause of so many sex-related incidents is simply wishful thinking on the part of pornography opponents. And I would suggest that the denial of this connection is the epitome of wishful thinking on their part. Proponents of pornography will further argue that there are no empirical studies demonstrating a direct cause and effect. And of course, they are correct. However, scientifically proving cause and effect in pornography is virtually impossible, because ethically, researchers cannot conduct the necessary research. Dolph Zillman, a leading researcher in this field, points out, quote, men cannot be placed at risk of developing sexually violent inclinations by extensive exposure to violent or nonviolent pornography. And women cannot be placed at risk of becoming victims of such inclinations, close quote. But this does not mean that the current body of research suggesting a correlation between pornography and the aforementioned effects can be completely dismissed either. In fact, a 1994 review of 81 original peer-reviewed research studies concluded that, quote, the empirical research on the effects of aggressive pornography shows with fairly impressive consistency that exposure to these materials has a negative effect on attitudes toward women and the perceived likelihood to rape. Close quote. In the absence of empirical scientific evidence, we are forced to rely upon logic and reason, along with a plethora of anecdotal evidence, which clearly demonstrates that pornography does indeed produce changes in attitudes and values. And with this in mind, we must therefore conclude that pornography is, in essence, sex education of the worst possible kind. It is capable of reorienting our natural sexuality into unnatural and unhealthy behaviors, both personally and socially. Again, if there is some suspicion that the drinking water is contaminated and people are getting sick after drinking it, the burden of proof shifts to proving it is safe, rather than having final conclusive proof that it is indeed toxic. And with that, I need a drink of water. And I speak to this issue as a Christian. But whether one is Christian or not, we all understand that the truth of a matter, if it is true, will correspond to reality and experience. While a way that is false or wrong will come into conflict with reality. In other words, there is a right way to live, and that way can be tested against the reality and experience of human beings. What is true will produce harmony, and what is wrong will produce harm. It's sort of like testing gravity. You may have some philosophical conception that there is no such thing as gravity. I may argue that, look, gravity is a very real and tangible force. You can't touch it, you can't see it, you can't smell it, but we can test it against reality. And we could go up to the roof of this building and throw a bowling ball off, and I can assure you, I can predict with 100% accuracy what's going to happen to that bowling ball every time. No matter how much you deny the truth of gravity, reality will demonstrate the truth of gravity. The same is true morally and ethically as well. Living in a way that is false will produce harm, while living in a way that is right morally and ethically will produce harmony. It's simply that simple. And such is the case with pornography. It fails at every single point. It does not produce harmony, and the only documented effects are overwhelmingly harmful. Pornography offers a false and disintegrating view of sexuality and relationships, which has proven in many cases to alter attitudes and values, which can then lead to even more destructive, antisocial, and sometimes criminal behavior. And if you do not personally rely on the biblical worldview for moral guidance, you may be tempted to ask, well, how on earth is the biblical basis for opposing pornography relevant to me? Well, let me share briefly the biblical teachings in this area that form a theological and coherent perspective regarding sexuality. And I think you would find this perspective to be both reasonable and one with which you would probably agree. First, the Bible teaches that God created men and women in His image. This endows men and women with intrinsic value. And God also made us sexual beings. He created us male and female. However, the Bible also teaches that as a result of the fall and sin, sex has been corrupted from its original intent and misused. This, I would argue, is painfully self-evident in today's culture. Pornography distorts God's design for sex by promoting sexual experience, body only, apart from the exclusive marriage relationship, a relationship that is intended to include the whole person. Again, psychological, emotional, as well as physical. And this is akin to Plato's mind-body dualism, which again is inconsistent with human experience and the desires of the human heart. We all seek an all-inclusive love in which our whole person is valued, not just our bodies. A biblical view of human sexuality recognizes that sexual intercourse is a gift exclusively reserved for lifelong monogamous marriage for the following purposes. First, it completes the one flesh union. This is the final act in the integration of human persons within the most intimate of human relationships. Secondly, it provides for sexual intimacy within the marriage bond. The use of the word no in Scripture indicates that sexual intercourse is intended to have profound meaning within the context of a covenant relationship, a mutually committed relationship. Thirdly, sexual intercourse, according to Scripture, is for the mutual pleasure of husband and wife. Fourth, sexual intercourse is for procreation. Marriage also provides for the manner and place in which children then come into being. That's kind of important. That's a compelling social interest. The Bible does not condemn sex in the slightest. Quite the contrary. Sex is a gift to be enjoyed. But like all good things, it is to be enjoyed within the safe physical and moral boundaries that provide for the mutual benefit of all. The biblical view actually enriches and ennobles the sexual passion. The contemporary culture destroys this. And I would argue that these boundaries, moral, physical boundaries, could be likened to sport that is played on a particular field or court within specific rules. A sport played within the context of its appropriate field, following the established rules, is far more enjoyable, meaningful, and safer. Conversely, attempts to play baseball, for example, in your local shopping mall, without any of the traditional rules, it may be fun. It may be fun to watch, but eventually something or somebody is going to get hurt. And the game eventually loses its significance and meaning. It has no meaning. It has no significance. I think this is precisely what we're doing to the issue of sex in our culture today. It no longer has any meaning or significance. It's been trivialized. And this is much the same with pornography. Sex is taken out of the safe and normal sphere of human experience, and the nature of sexual intimacy is reduced in its significance and meaning, all of which has been demonstrated to cause harm to individuals and society. In conclusion, society has a moral obligation to prevent the emission of toxic pollutants that can cause harm to the body. In much the same way that we take steps to protect the body from exposure to such toxins, we must also take steps to protect the soul from the toxic moral effects of pornography and its messages. America is under siege from pornography and its distorted view of sex, women, and relationships. Public morality has degenerated, and behavior once thought immoral and deviant is now primetime entertainment. As revealed in a recent study conducted by Dartmouth Medical School, even secular science is beginning to recognize the inevitable results of moral, spiritual, and religious indifference on society. In the wake of documenting unprecedented rates of teen drug and alcohol abuse, sexually transmitted disease, rates of mental illness, teen pregnancy, and suicide, all of which have skyrocketed in the last 20 years, researchers from Dartmouth, Harvard, Columbia, and Yale concluded, quote, "For what may be the first time, a diverse group of scientists and other experts on children's health is publicly recommending that our society pay considerably more attention to young people's moral, spiritual, and religious needs." Close quote. It is the duty of rational beings to sometimes make strong judgments about what is false, unjust, or evil. We are compelled by conscience to call for debate, deliberation, and decisions that benefit our common life as citizens and community with one another. And I fully expect these decisions to be based on rational thought and reasonable conclusions that seek the common good and not simply self-serving religious interests. This is not a matter of the Christian right trying to impose its values on the rest of America. As a Christian theologian and philosopher, I'm not against pornography as much as I am for healthy human sexuality and relationships. Pornography not only opposes these ends, but actually, I would add, undermines these ends, destroys these ends, and in the process does great harm to human beings, real people. I would submit to you that the biblical view of human sexuality is both superior to the pornographic and efficacious for both individuals and society. It works. It serves the common goals of human beings who want to live happily and in harmony with one another. It is therefore a matter of compassion and justice that I would recommend opposition to the unrestricted production and distribution of pornography. I think this is the only reasonable conclusion. I thank you for your time. Are we going to have some time for questions or...